Welcome to failure. I'm just gonna leave.
Yeah, we'll dwell in our own.
Don't leave. Some new faces here. Again, these are standalone sessions, but my name is Petter Joth, and I teach at St. Olaf College. This session is looking at biblical stories, in particular the stories of Adam and Eve, as well as Judas. I think we'll start with Judas today, of the stories. Asking questions about failure. What we're also doing here is my wife is also teaching sessions, and she's going to teach a session tonight at 6, from 6 to 7:20, and she'll lay to, which you can have more time to sort of digest this. We decided to try link sessions this year. We also decided to do themes as opposed to very specific things to sort of invite us into conversation, because the best part about teaching about Holden is all of you. Not saying you're experts at failure, but that's me. No. But the collaborative nature of conversation here, that's why it's so much fun to do this for me. So I don't pretend to be the expert. Or actually, I do pretend to be the expert, but I'm not. Because we're all in this together. And that's a real delight. So with that in mind, what I'd like you to do is find someone you do not know. I know, I do that every day. Holden, again, as a community, all of us are members, all of us are linked. Right here, find someone you do not know, say hi to them, say where you come from, introduce yourself, and then I'd like you each to share a story of failure. And what kind of emotions or memories does thinking about failure dredge up in you? Kind of, how do you experience your experience?
Shame.
Long-lasting shame.
Non-remembrance.
Oh, okay. Avoidance?
Avoidance, yes.
Sadness?
Yeah. Really extraordinary grief.
So what, I heard learning?
Learning never goes away.
Regret?
Wishing you could redo.
What have you got?
Yeah. Embarrassment.
Yeah. Relief it wasn't worse.
Hey, that's positive. Never mind.
Okay. Anyone else? Feeling like I could have succeeded if I'd worked harder.
Okay.
Blame from yourself, maybe?
I'm wondering where the secret of success lies, and you never found it.
Okay, so a sense of not knowing the rules, right? Knowing.
I have to tell you, when I walked in from a nice walk, I felt pretty good. Talking about failure for 2 minutes. So you have us kind of in a low area.
Yeah.
I'm hoping you can share to bring us back up.
I
don't
want to
put you on the spot. But
yeah, no, that's good.
I've been to enough conferences in this group. We have expectations.
You want to end on an hour? I can't do that for you.
He has a song and dance number for the end that really will raise our
Good.
When I did CPE in a hospital in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and everyone else called me the chaplain of death.
Guess everybody died?
I'm someone, and my wife would probably concur with this, in fact, we're talking about this, I can be sort of intense, and I'm not always good with sort of personal interactions with people who have a cold. But if you have a serious, injury, or you're facing huge existential questions, I'm your guy. Which meant I kind of failed in a lot of, that's one of the things that I really respected about CPE. It forced me to sort of
work
on
that. What is CPB?
CPE is Clinical Pastoral Education.
Oh, okay. That's the code.
Sorry about that. I failed again. So we'll see where we end up, because, again, many times when I teach in here, I have less of an agenda, and I'm much more about asking these kinds of questions and working them out together. And so how do we, as members of this body, the body of Christ here at Railroad Creek Valley, talk about and think about failure in response and in relationship to our culture, broad culture, but also our sacred tradition, the Bible? So with that in mind, I want to start here. When I researched this, I actually found a museum of failure. And this is some of the exhibits. One is this. This is ketchup. It's purple ketchup.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently a stellar blue ketchup.
Oh, man.
Then orange-flavored breakfast cereal, which my children would probably like.
Yeah.
But I don't, I could not find any information on that. But it looks like Kada to me.
What?
C-A-Y-D-A. It looks to me like...
Oh, that's great. Thanks, honey.
Is this museum at Trump Tower?
I think it's in Southern California. But I,
oh, yeah. Okay. So,
they didn't have a lot of information on it, but you can go visit it. But, so something else I do when I talk about things like this is I try to think that we are all imaginative thinkers. We live in a culture, but we're also creatures of our imagination, which we put together dimensions of our identity based on sort of the narratives and expectations and social norms of our culture. Some philosophers call this a worldview or a social imaginary. One of them is, in our culture, I think, when we talk about failure, we're really talking about success. And when we're told what success is, often it's quantifiable. You can measure it. You have a certain social standing. You have a certain level of income. You live in the right neighborhood. You drive the right car. You wear the right kind of clothes. You went to the right kind of schools. You have the right kind of friends.
They're all male. They're all dressed exactly the same, like in uniform.
They're all attorneys.
Well, that's
so excess is white, male, necktie.
Briefcase, yeah.
On pyramids.
Heterosexual, probably, too.
Yep.
Cisgender.
Yeah. All clouds look exactly the right.
Yeah.
They look like they're in How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. Mm-hmm. You know that musical?
The musical, yeah.
They're not helping each other up the top, either. Mm-hmm.
It's like pitching the fire in, or was it Iwo Jima?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Looks like Iwo Jima.
Not Tsubarashi.
They're all saying in that sign, pick me.
Mm-hmm. They're all looking up rather than next to each other or down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you think this represents sort of our conventional standard of success?
They all look like they could very easily slip.
Yeah, can I also think though that there are variations of this in different social circles. So I also think about, like, once I became a mom, there were very specific things that might represent success in the land of parenting, right? And we talked about, like, beauty and, you know, like, you should definitely have a yoga body, and your kids should not be crying, and there should be kale for every meal, and, like, I mean, you know, there were, no, but it was, like, you were clearly not going to be as successful if you didn't have, like, the bento box that didn't have the chemicals, and, I mean, I think that, like, yes, this is, like, a certain frame, but, like, we all experience variations of this in whatever kind of social milieu we're sort of in, you know?
And I'll call you on the yoga body. I'm trying to reimagine.
Oh, yeah! Thanks, I love yoga! But there can be competitive.
But you're just saying
moments,
that.
Right?
It's like, exactly what people think when it's yoga, that you have to have this buff physique, that you can do all these contortions, and there's not the modification in there. And we have to modify what success is.
And Anne does a great job, let me just say, in teaching yoga here, for letting people know that that is not actually the point of yoga anyway.
Exactly. Yeah.
But can we then say that all of us sort of at some point are shaped by more conventional expectations of success?
Sure.
Are we face it in different ways, and we inhabit the expectations, the norms, in different ways, and we resist them in some ways, but we also accept them in some ways, subconsciously or unconsciously, unintentionally. It's part of our story. I also found this was interesting in relationship to failure. This is a Gallup poll. In terms of defining well-being, only about percent of the United States in 2017 defined themselves as being well. It's gone down, as you can tell, from 2016. Not really sure why.
Peter, I don't know why this thought came to mind, but I watched the documentary on Steve Jobs, Jobs and Jobs, and there was high incidence of suicide at a factory, one of the examples in a factory in China.
Foxconn. Mm-hmm.
And his response, or the company's response to the high suicide, people were jumping off of the apartment building, and his response to that was putting up nets so that people wouldn't hit the ground. And I thought, talk about success for a company. I mean, it blew me away that would be the response, other than to do.
That's a practical solution, probably not digging deep enough.
Right, right. Yeah. It just creates.
I mean, it solved people from killing themselves, but maybe, I don't want to go there.
So success at what cost?
Quantifiable.
I mean, a very exaggerated example.
Yeah. I mean, I know talking about suicide has been a rash in the public, but I think because of Anthony Bourdain, I know the Minneapolis Star Tribune had an article on suicide in Minnesota. Yeah. I think it's gone up 40% over the last, 5 years.
Yeah. You're saying up 40%?
No, it was up 20%, but higher in the Twin Cities.
Oh, maybe that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's been up since Robert Williams.
Oh.
And those are successful
suicides. Yeah. And I'm certainly not trying to say we can solve this dilemma, but or make an easy one-to-one relationship between our cultural definition of success and well-being and whatnot. But it does certainly make us think that lots of people are not feeling successful, they feel like failures. Some of the experiences you brought forth when you talked about your own failures, blame, shame, pain, regret, some of the probably more negative, but also more positive, like something I learned from.
So is your assumption that if we feel successful, we will have a sense of well-being?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I'm willing to open that up.
You have to define what success is. I'm sure you'll get to that. The picture you showed before is more of a... It's a success that our society puts on us.
Or put the other way, can we have a sense of well-being without success?
That's a great question. Can we have a sense of well-being without conventional success?
Can we have a feeling of success without conventional success, Randy Anderson? Yeah.
I do think my point here isn't to clearly define it or really to say exactly how it shapes us, but to suggest that our culture shapes us. And there are definitions of success that we don't live up to within our own kind of cultural milieu.
I have heard in more than one place that failure is good. Mm-hmm. Because if you have a failure, you should, like with children, they can't always be successful. They have to have failure somewhere in their life because then they know how to deal with it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up because I teach at CMLS and I bet you Kate will concur with this. A lot of my students are utterly afraid of any kind of failure. Mm-hmm. Because they think their future well-being rests on getting a B+ in my religion class, even though they're going to go to med school. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of research that says that kids that are helped to go through failure have more resilience mm-hmm. down the road. Mm-hmm. And there's proof of it.
Great, great issues down there.
I was just going to say, I was a principal for many years of a middle school, and I would tell all the hovering, nervous parents when they came in, I said, middle school, is the best time for your kids to fail. Because there aren't any really lasting consequences. And they have to learn that they aren't the smartest and the brightest and the most talented kid. And this is, you know, if you can work it, it's a very safe milieu to fail in. But it's hard for parents to hear that.
Probably because parents are shaped by their own sense of failure and want to fix it.
Sure.
And your children.
I know I've experienced that. Moving more now to the theological when it comes to issues of failure. What I think failure does, and I'm using Kierkegaard, the theologian here, what he argues is that when it comes to issues like failure, what failure does is it impacts us as a particular individual, that you feel your failure, you experience your own failure. You carry that burden in your body and in your person. It makes you feel alone, it makes you feel isolated. In part because I think we have a society that still venerates success and doesn't necessarily offer us healthy ways to say, I failed, and I talk about it. So Kira writes this, thus offense, and I'm using offense here as similar to failure, is related to the single individual. And with this, Christianity begins. That is, with making every man a single individual, an individual sinner. Now it's gendered there, but you carry your failure. You carry that shame. You carry that regret. You carry that blame. For Kierkegaard, it actually is where Christianity begins. Because of that, it makes you aware of something greater than yourself, believe it or not, at the same time. So what he writes here is, this is practice in Christianity, the truth of Christian existence is that the Christian must suffer, or about how a person in order to become and remain a Christian must endure sufferings that he consequently can avoid simply by refraining from becoming a Christian.
Interesting.
Kierkegaard's point here is that in many ways, Christians have this notion of sin. A notion that we fail at being the people we're supposed to be, called by God to be. And by recognizing that, it places sort of a burden upon us. In maybe a Lutheran tradition, it's the law. I am not the person I'm supposed to be. I do not live the way I want to live, the way that God has told me I can live and called me. I do not love my neighbor as myself. I put this together. I was actually thinking of the liturgical sentence. I know it's still in the ELW, but from LBW. I do not love my neighbor as myself. Those confessions at the beginning of the church.
I was going to say, it seems like that the idea of turning the other cheek implies failure. You either fail because you did something wrong, or you fail because you didn't follow through and correct it.
I'm just wondering, with all of the rates of things going up, if, you know, Christianity offers, you know, as we talked about failure, right? I bet most of us talked about individual moments of failure, and that Christianity teaches us how to, you know, seek forgiveness or to learn from that experience. You know, that was brought up and stuff, but that with the way that we're connected to the world, we're like hyper aware of our failings as a nation and our failings as institutions, and that there is a feeling that we are responsible for that, but it is hard to figure out how to make reparations and how to learn from that and how to do better so that we are implicated in failures, that we are not given good enough. Or, I don't know, like, it's hard to see how to make those failures better or how to learn from them because you're a part of this thing that feels so much bigger than you. And I wonder if just, what do we do with communal failure, I guess?
That's a really good point, because there are theologians who are critical of the Lutheran tradition. If you know anything about Luther struggled with these unfectum and these sort of demons his whole life, and he could never sort of, he could never get out of that pit of despair. As Carrie already sort of known to that too. Which sort of privileges a certain kind of experience in the world of feeling like a failure sort of constantly, which I know not everyone has. Luther's response, Kierkegaard's response too, is to say, well, there's God's grace and God's forgiveness through Jesus. And the reality is that the attempt to live both, simultaneously a sinner and simultaneously saved, and the challenge then is to, when you're in those dark moments, to find the light. And when you're in the light, also to see the darkness. Because it's both, it's not either or. I think that's the energy of the Lutheran tradition. It's obviously not always lived out very well, but yeah.
Kind of two things with this. One, I remember reading an essay by when I was 30 years ago by Rafael Lopez Pedraza called The Consciousness of Failure. Mm-hmm. It had a huge impact on me at the time. Mm-hmm. And it's anyone who can find it, I would suggest look at it. It's not easy to find necessarily. And another friend back around that time, I was probably in my 20s, early 20s, you have the poem, you know, I figured success just about like most, no, success like most things was just about used up. Mm-hmm. Like he made a turn away from really success as his orientation, and he really did kind of do that. But the other thing was about a language of, we don't really have much of a language of failure, and I don't even want to kind of like stand on that and say, we don't have a language of failure, but more really, finding one would have really a lot of implications, like a flower that fails into fruit. You know, what is something failing into? Because really, we fail into almost anything that we really move into, alter for it.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
What, couldn't you say that to a scientist, failure is good work?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's the pathway to discovery.
Which suggests that we can have different attitudes towards our experience of failure.
Sometimes you need to have that attitude, because if you tried one, as a scientist, if you tried one time and you failed and you didn't examine it and try again, there'd never be a discovery.
Which also brings up Meredith's point of resilience, perseverance. Sort of recognizing failure as a part of what it means to be human.
I worked in China. The culture of working with those people over there is they can't afford to fail. They can't afford it in that culture. They'd be criticized. And that's the worst thing that could happen to someone.
I think part of the thing is to recognize when to give up on things and when to continue. Mm-hmm. Like Edison, I believe, tried thousands of maybe up to 3,000 attempts to form a light bulb. He just would not give up. So he didn't give up, but sometimes, like at one time, I thought I was an actor, and I went to New York City and I take a good look around. I said, thousands and thousands of people heading for very talented, but heading for failure, so because they would not give up. So I think part of the problem is to know when to give up and go on to something else.
That's good.
Yeah. I hope I'm not, well, anyway. What I'm thinking of is the Twins have a right fielder that starts with a K. I can't think of his name right now.
Kepler. Max Kepler.
Max Kepler. Okay, so I just happened to be at the Twins game Memorial Day weekend, and they were going up against Paxton, who is a very good left-handed pitcher. And I saw a statistic that said that Kepler has the major league, the highest average, 330-something, against left-handed pitchers. And then he gets up like in either the third or the fourth inning, and he nailed one. I mean, my God, when I was right there, and the sound, and that thing just went out. Now, Kepler fails two-thirds of the time, but he's considered one of the best hitters in Major League Baseball in that category.
Different definition of success, right?
Yeah.
Thank you.
So before we leave purgatory,
yeah.
I've never thought of this, but in a church service that we're all familiar with, they talk about forgiveness of your sins. Mm-hmm. And that's refreshing as far as sinning. It gives you some relief and you can start up again. But I never put the connection between failure and sin. Yeah, and I'd ask you as a theologian, does it make sense to say in your mind forgiveness of your failures? Because it's really, in my mind, I never thought of that as a sin, to fail. I mean, you try, you do your best. But what I'm looking for is some comfort. I mean, that's what you do in this world when you fail.
I think it depends if you're failing to reach your own expectations or whatever, or if you're failing to reach what God wants of you, because those are not always the same thing.
So I have to be a little careful about making them too synonymous. Well, just a thought. I appreciate that's what these are about.
Maybe please run a little deeper. He argues, he has a book that's in part based on Kierkegaard, so the nature and destiny of man. You can tell how old these texts are because everything's man. But one of the things he argues is that everyone equally is a sinner, but not equally guilty. That guilt and sin are two different concepts. So he writes this, men who are equally sinners instead of God need not be equally guilty of a specific act of wrongdoing in which they are involved. It is important to recognize that biblical religion has emphasized this inequality of guilt just as much as the equality of sin. Primary source of Orthodox Lutheranism's inability to deal with effectively with specific moral issues is its blindness to the prophetic note in scriptures, in which those who are particularly guilty of moral wrongdoing are constantly signaled out. Specifically, severe judgments fall upon the rich and the powerful, the mighty and the noble, the wise and the righteous, that is, those who are tempted to spiritual pride by their attainment of some relative, socially approved standard of righteousness. So he comes up with sort of a two-tier system, I guess you would say. Everyone equally is a sinner. But depending on your social standing and your culture, sort of your definition of success, there's different degrees of guilt. Which I think is an interesting way to think about, in part because of some of the things I know Cato is pushing a little bit about the, what do we do corporately? We're all Americans. Because we're all Americans, we're all involved in our immigration policies. We're all Americans, we're involved in our climate change policies. I mean, all of us, to some degree, are guilty because we use fossil fuels, I'm assuming, to get here. I certainly did. We flew. Holden's a very fossil fuel intensive location because you can't grow food here, especially in the winters. There's guilt there. And Niebuhr's point is maybe we're less guilty than the oil worker pulling oil using frack sand and alone. Though we're all sinners.
So does he have a measuring stick for that?
Neighbor?
Yeah.
For
guilt.
Yeah.
One of the definitions of sin, or there's different words in the Bible that get translated as sin, but I'm trying to remember, is missing the mark.
Hamartia, yeah.
Yeah. And in that sense, you know, if I'm at archery and I hit the target, but it's not the target that I'm supposed to be aiming at, and I've really missed the mark.
Sure.
And that's a failure. You know, I wouldn't get any points at the
archer agenda.
In engineering, that's called precise. You're hitting a mark, but it's not accurate.
So that would be an example of what you were saying about a failure that's sin, the missing the mark.
I wish it was that simple.
Well, the archery part is an easy example, but...
But I like the discussion that there is similarity. There is difference, too, between sin and failure.
Yeah. Well, that particular...
But it struck me, again, going back in a service that we all attend, you're forgiven for sin, and it's just thought, well, gosh, there's some connection with sin and failure, too. But there's also some difference. You've got to be careful.
Failure is not always
a sin.
Also, failure comes in so many different portals, so to speak, like failing someone else, failing a child, failing a partner, or failing a parent. Three octaves right there that are in themselves different. Then I'm a builder, and the question of whether the material that I'm working with will fail, and being responsible for actually having some sense some accurate sense of whether it would or will not. It's all the engineering thing and so forth, but still carrying this concern, or that somebody else that's working with you will fail in some way where the client's being failed, and there's going to be repercussions and whatnot. But it's interesting that it can really get quite broad beyond the simplest thing of like that picture, going up that mountain. We can still relate quite strongly to failure in so many broad ways. Has many opportunities.
Really complex when we start to think about it, don't we?
Yeah.
I find that failure for me is a lot of not knowing whether I'm going to fail, and so I don't act.
Mm-hmm.
And then kicking myself afterwards because I didn't act, and finding all sorts of ways that I could have acted that seemed right, but. I didn't follow through.
Okay.
So
not acting. Yeah.
Another part of that liturgy I think you're referring to is sins known and unknown.
Yeah.
There's a mystery to all of this, and we don't even know how our failures hurt others.
Those are the tough ones. Yeah. You sinned and you don't even know it.
I just met Sue, so we exchanged failure stories, like you do when you first meet someone. But but what was interesting for both of us, what came up were ways in which we failed someone else, like someone close to us, like a parent, sibling. And we kind of stepped back and asked the question of, like, can we actually think of failures that where it was our own expectations versus that of someone else? And just the piece about expectations was in there. I mean, and that could be other things, expectations that God has of us. That, but it just was interesting how so often, like, what really hurts us, I think that's why it came up for us, it's the ways in which we have failed those that we love. So that just was really striking. But just how expectations play into that was really interesting.
A joke in our marriage, Kayla had very low expectations.
That's great.
It's worked so far.
Well, we're still married after this week. I mean,
yeah.
We'll see what happens after the session.
That's right.
You're a winner.
Another, I think, dimension to this conversation that the Christian tradition brings is the notion of anxiety. Again, I'm using a tradition that includes Kierkegaard and Bonhoeffer, frankly, but also Paul Tillich, who I suspect a number of you are familiar with. And, he wrote a book called Courage to Be, which I still use with undergrads at NOLA and still speaks to them profoundly, though there's a lot of dense language in it. But what he writes is sort of existentially experienced anxiety. So he writes this: a profound ambiguity between good and evil permeates everything we do because it permeates our personal being. So on the one hand, we have a sense, we have some expectation of what's good behavior, or what's expected of us, or hitting the mark. Success, I think any of those terms can fit in there. But we also have a sense of its opposite. And Tillich's point is he thinks that's inherent in our being, inherent in who we are. If you can say inherent in our DNA. Along with that, we have a sense of, for Tillich, death. that because we live, because we have life, because we have being, that's the fancy word he uses, we also, alongside of that, have a sense that at some point our being will not be. So non-being, i.e. an awareness of death, is mixed with being in our moral self-affirmation, as it is in his spiritual and physical self-affirmation. It's part of how we see ourselves. It's part of how we make sense of ourselves in the world. It's part of how we have courage and find hope, despite those, that experience of evil and non-being. The awareness of this ambiguity is the feeling of guilt. That we know we're supposed to do something, or we did something that is mixed in with what we didn't do. Like, all of us could be out, we could be in El Paso today. But where are we?
At a retreat center.
Liturgical worshiping community.
And well cared for, I think.
The judge who is oneself, who stands against oneself, we who know with, that the conscience actually means knows with. Everything we do and are given a negative judgment experienced by us is guilt. It is present in every moment of moral self-awareness and can drive us toward complete self-rejection, to the feeling of being condemned, not to an external punishment, but to the despair of having lost our destiny. A lot of dense concepts there. I think if we simplify it, I think what Tillich is really getting at is all of us have a sense of a goal, some hope, something that drives us. And on the way to that end, to our destiny, as Tillich calls it, there are moments where we recognize that we're failing, that we're not doing the good we're supposed to do. And for Tillich, he kind of uses these interchangeably, despair and anxiety. He thinks that, again, this is part of who we are. For Tillich's answer is that we have courage. And he also believes the importance of ritual and forgiveness, some of the things that we've also hinted at here, to enable that. I also thought I'd put this in here because it also has shaped our world a little bit. What's guilt, anxiety for Freud? You have these impulses. Society says, I'm sorry, you can't fulfill your impulses. These impulses are instinctual. I guess society will punish me for having these instinctual desires. Marry your mother. Freud. Very different tradition, but it's part of our cultural lingo.
Is that soap available anywhere?
What?
That's soap,
yeah. Freud forgiveness soap.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it is.
Where did you find that?
Online.
That's good.
Wash the face. I know there's like Lutheran mints too. Mm-hmm. They're called compliments. Some of those. I think I'll skip this because I want to get to the Bible. I think we've had a really rich conversation. We're confused. But the way that confusion works is it leads us to talk to each other and collaborate with each other. So the first thing I want us to do, I want us to look at, I thought we'd start with Judas, in part because Genesis is something that many of us are familiar with. The Bible study has been doing it too. What I'd like you to do then is, since maybe find two, three other people, I'd like you to talk through the Judas account. What is your experience of failure in reading Judas? What do you hear? What resonates with your experience? And what does that ask of us to think about in terms of our relationship to God's grace and Jesus? I was reading Judas and Matthew in the midst of the conversation of failure impact you? How does reading Judas in a conversation of failure impact you?
Right.
Judas is the only one who sort of comes back.
So, one more time.
Out of all the 12, Judas is the only one who comes back. They all left. But Judas is the only one who comes back.
Comes back to?
Comes back to where?
Comes back to okay. Judas comes back as a sign and symbol of the old system of payment that does not work. Mm-hmm. I try to always ask myself, how am I going to preach this? I mean, I always do that. How does this one going to preach? And I know I preached on the opposite side. Well, he went and killed himself. But, I mean, is that all that we can learn from this? I think Judas stands as a symbol of the old system. He is the one who conveys to us that the old system doesn't work.
Mm. Yeah. You know, I asked my pastor some question about Judas some time ago about did Judas's actions betraying Jesus, was that part of God's plan? Because it wouldn't have worked without Judas betraying. And her answer to me, which I never thought occurred to me, was that God makes good things happen out of bad actions. So it doesn't mean that God wanted Judas to betray Jesus.
So going back to the notion that I know Diane Jacobson brought this up this morning, that in some ways it's our response. She talked about Katrina. Mm-hmm. How Katrina was a natural act. God's response was the people who helped respond to Katrina.
Right.
So failure, maybe the issue with failure is not so much the failure itself, it's how you respond to the failure, which I know some of you sort of hinted at when you talked about it.
It's interesting how Judas is returning the money gives them a problem, a new problem.
Yeah.
What they solve with a wild irony of find a land to bury foreigners into, which could end up happening to the tradition within 70 years, where it's going to settle this question of we're kind of essentially buried into that field. We're foreigners, we're not Jews.
But they had to hang on to the old system. They themselves, the chief priests, could not escape. They hung on to their old system. And Judas says, oh, there's something new here.
Yeah.
I think the Christian failure looks like the chief priest's failure, and that's the failure to forgive.
Mm. Yeah. In part because Judas repents, and by repenting,
Well, if somebody comes to you and repents, or apologizes, or whatever form of repentance they, and you say, I'm not having any of it. I think that's a failure on our part.
But they would have had to acknowledge their own sin and failure.
Well, I'm not talking about them, I'm talking about me.
Okay, but she's amping it up. This is part of what that must shake out like.
But I think you're right. I mean, when you forgive, you have to acknowledge your own complicity in whatever the issue was between you and the other person.
It's harder to forgive as a group, though, too. I mean, if there was, it was just the chief priest, he might have been able to forgive. But he had a group that he was responsible for and taken action.
So is there a way, I think, in the Christian tradition to fail well?
Well, not feel good about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
If Judas would have had enough imagination to
figure out what he could do, recognizing he had made a mistake. He could have been another significant apostle that we're reading about.
But he did repent.
He did repent.
He repented, but he judged himself very harshly.
Yeah. That's certainly true.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think he was given forgiveness. That's what we're talking about. That's kind of the Old Testament way of dealing with priests. The New Testament would have given him forgiveness, or whether he would have taken the same action or not.
We were talking about whether it would have been different if he would have, you know, because this is before Jesus dies, and like, is that what would have opened up the possibility of him sort of forgiving himself? I mean, you know, like there's about to be this amazing act of forgiveness of sins, right? And this is kind of one of the last things that happens before then. And so is this kind of, do we look at this as like what happens before this possibility that Jesus opens up to us about forgiveness happens, you know? But he didn't have that, right? Like, Jesus hadn't done that yet.
Well, except to be technical about it, he was at the table.
Yeah.
When Jesus said, this is my body,
yeah,
this is my blood, and he shared that, he received it.
Well, but that was Christ, that wasn't the priest. The priest.
Right, thing. But I'm talking about whether or not he was forgiven.
Right.
I guess.
Didn't didn't Judas look at success, what success was, through the eyes of the world? And was he trying to force Jesus to come forward and claim his throne? Which would be more of an earthly throne, or earthly throne. And therefore, that was a mistake that Judas made.
But to me, it's always interesting, too, because you're familiar with the Gospel of Mark. All the disciples, none of them figure out who Jesus is in Mark. And repeatedly, they go, Jesus at one point, maybe it's Mark 12 or something, Jesus goes, you know, if you follow me, pick up your cross. And right after that, the disciples start to argue who's going to be the king, who's going to be next to Jesus when he ascends his throne, because they think it's a worldly thing. So
sure.
Part of the tradition, too, of the disciples. Go ahead.
It's probably too little too late, but I find myself questioning the success-failure opposites in relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I reflect on the story that I shared with Lars, the opposite of that is not success. I mean, where I fell short, if I were to deconstruct what happened, there's a whole lot of that I will never understand. But it was the erosion and the dissolution of a relationship. And success is not the opposite of that in my mind.
Yeah.
And so I, in the same way that there's different ways of assessing what constitutes success, depending on whether we're talking about pastoral ministry or for the practice of medicine or, you know, in business, I think for me, success, I'm not sure how that applies in the context of relationships. Unless we're talking about the positive gift of a successful marriage,
sure.
That has probably got all kinds of complications, troubles, setbacks, failures.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, you think about the question up there, what does Christian failure look like? I think failure is what Christianity looks like. That's a very theological cross thing to say. I think that like what we have is a tradition where the disciples don't recognize what's going on. Jesus does not succeed while he is still alive. It's only in an ultimate failure that the tradition has its birth. And so Christianity isn't a successful religion. It is a religion that dwells in the failings of all of us.
Which I think it becomes then, the Christian story is an invitation to walk towards our failure. Like it is walk towards death, knowing, being curious about failure, our falling, why this has happened. Like that's how we move towards resurrection. Like you have to go towards it to get to the other, what's on the other side of it. Like that's
into the tomb.
Yeah.
And maybe Judas is not being forgiven is maybe a societal thing that we have a hard time forgetting. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can read that into that too, forgiving ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Judas is such a complex figure.
Yeah.
But I know we're about to long to say. To me, I love the way Sarah ended it. And in part, these kinds of conversations, I think, are what allow us to go to the Lord with us. It's a part of who we are, but also not the end of the story. And to take that in this body and relish that as we relish the grace that God gives us. So, thank you.
Thank you.